Tiresias' fame of prophecy was spread through all the cities of Aeonia for his unerring answers unto all who listened to his words. And first of those that hearkened to his fateful prophecies, a lovely nymph named Liriope came with her dear son, who then 15 might seem a man or boy. He who was born to her upon the green merge of Cephissus' stream, that mighty river god whom she declared the father of her boy. She questioned him, imploring him to tell her if her son, unequalled for his beauty, whom she called Narcissus, might attain a ripe old age. To which the blind seer answered in these words, "If he but fail to recognize himself, a long life he may have beneath the sun." So, frivolous, the prophet's words appeared. And yet the event, the manner of his death, the strange delusion of his frenzied love, confirmed it. 3 times 5 years so are passed. Another 5 years, and the lad might seem a young man or a boy, and many a youth and many a damsel sought to gain his love. But such his mood and spirit and his pride, none gained his favour. Once a noisy nymph, who never held her tongue when others spoke, who never spoke till others had begun, mocking Echo, spied him as he drove, in his delusive nets, some timid stags. For Echo was a nymph in olden time, and more than fabled sound, possessed a form, and she was then deprived the use of speech, except to babble and repeat the words, once spoken, over and over. Juno confused her silly tongue, because she often held that glorious goddess with her endless tales, till many a hapless nymph from Jove's embrace had made escape adown a mountain. But for this, the goddess might have caught them. Thus, the glorious Juno, when she knew her guile, "Your tongue, so freely wagged at my expense, shall be of little use, your endless voice much shorter than your tongue." At once the nymph was stricken as the goddess had decreed, and, ever since, she only mocks the sounds of others' voices, or, perchance, returns their final words. One day, when she observed Narcissus wandering in the pathless woods, she loved him, and she followed him, with soft and stealthy tread. The more she followed him, the hotter did she burn, as when the flame flares upward from the sulphur on the torch. Oh, how she longed to make her passion known, to plead in soft entreaty, to implore his love. But now, till others have begun, a mute of nature she must be. She cannot choose but wait the moment when his voice may give to her an answer. Presently the youth, by chance divided from his trusted friends, cries loudly, "Who is here?" And Echo, "Here," replies. Amazed, he casts his eyes around and calls with louder voice, "Come here." "Come here," she calls the youth who calls. He turns to see who calls him, and, beholding naught, exclaims, "Avoid me not, avoid me not," returns. He tries again, and is deceived by this alternate voice, and calls aloud, "Oh, let us come together," Echo cries, "Oh, let us come together." Never sound seemed sweeter to the nymph, and from the woods she hastens in accordance with her words, and strives to wind her arms around his neck. He flies from her, and as she leaves her, says, "Take off your hands, you shall not fold your arms around me, better death than such a one should ever caress me." Nor she answers, save, "Caress me." Thus rejected, she lies hid in the deep woods, hiding her blushing face with the green leaves, and ever after lives concealed in lonely caverns in the hills. But her great love increases with neglect, her miserable body wastes away. Wakeful with sorrows, leanness shrivels up her skin, and all her lovely features melt, as if dissolved upon the wafting winds. Nothing remains except her bones and voice. Her voice continues in the wilderness, her bones have turned to stone. She lies concealed in the wild woods, nor is she ever seen on lonely mountain range, for, though we hear her calling in the hills, 'tis but a voice that lives among the hills. Thus he deceived the nymph and many more, sprung from the mountains or the sparkling waves, and thus he slighted many an amorous youth. And therefore, someone whom he once despised, lifting his hands to heaven, implored the gods, "If he should love, deny him what he loves." And as the prayer was uttered, it was heard by Nemesis, who granted her assent. There was a fountain silver clear and bright, which neither shepherds nor the wild she-goats that ranged the hills, nor any cattle's mouth had touched. Its waters were unsullied, birds disturbed it not, nor animals, nor boughs that fall so often from the trees. Around sweet grasses nourished by the stream grew, trees that faded from the sun let balmy airs temper its waters. Here Narcissus, tired of hunting in the heat at noon, lay down, attracted by the peaceful solitudes and by the grassy spring. There, as he stooped to quench his thirst, another thirst increased. While he is drinking, he beholds himself reflected in the mirrored pool, and loves. Loves an imagined body which contains no substance, for he deems the mirrored shade a thing of life to love. He cannot move, so he marvels at himself, and lies with countenance unchanged, as if indeed a statue carved of Parian marble. Long, supine upon the bank, his gaze is fixed on his own eyes, twin stars. His fingers shaped as Bacchus might desire, his flowing hair as glorious as Apollo's, and his cheeks youthful and smooth. His ivory neck, his mouth dreaming in sweetness, his complexion fair and blushing as the rose and snowdrift white. All that is lovely in himself he loves, and in his witless way he wants himself. He who approves is equally approved. He seeks, is sought, he burns and is burned. And how he kisses the deceitful fount, and how he thrusts his arms to catch the neck that's pictured in the middle of the stream. Yet never may he wreathe his arms around that image of himself. He knows not what he there beholds, but what he sees inflames his longing, and the error that deceives allures his eyes. But why, O foolish boy, so vainly catching at this flitting form? The cheat that you are seeking has no place. Avert your gaze, and you will lose your love, for this that holds your eyes is nothing save the image of yourself reflected back to you. It comes and waits with you. It has no life. It will depart if you will only go. Nor food nor rest can draw him thence, outstretched upon the overshadowed green. His eyes fixed on the mirrored image never may know their longing satisfied. And by their sight he is himself undone. Raising himself a moment, he extends his arms around and beckoning to the murmuring forest. Oh, ye ill woods, was ever a man in love more fatally than I? Your silent paths have sheltered many a one whose love was stalled, and ye have never heard their voices. Ages fast have rolled away since your forgotten birth, but who is he, through all those weary years, that ever pined away as I? Alas, this fatal image wins my love, as I behold it, but I cannot press my arms around the form I see, the form that gives me joy. What strange mistake has intervened betwixt us and our love? It grieves me more that neither lands nor seas nor mountains, no, nor walls with closed gates deny our loves, but only a little water keeps us far asunder. Surely he desires my love and my embraces, for as oft I strive to kiss him, bending to the limpid stream my lips, so often does he hold his face fondly to me, and vainly struggles up. It seems that I could touch him. 'Tis a strange delusion that is keeping us apart. Whoever thou art, come up, deceive me not. Oh, whither, when I fain pursue, art thou? Ah, surely I am young and fair, the nymphs have loved me, and when I behold thy smiles, I cannot tell thee what sweet hopes arise. When I extend my loving arms to thee, thine also are extended me. Thy smiles return my own. When I was weeping, I have seen thy tears, and every sign I make thou cost return. And often thy sweet lips have seemed to move that peradventure words, which I have never heard, thou hast returned. No more my shade deceives me, I perceive this eye in thee, I love myself. The flame arises in my breast and burns my heart. What shall I do? Shall I at once implore, or should I linger till my love is sought? What is it I implore? The thing that I desire is mine, abundance makes me poor. Oh, I am tortured by a strange desire unknown to me before, for I would fain put off this mortal form, which only means I wish the object of my love away. Grief saps my strength, the sands of life are run, and in my early youth I am cut off. But death is not my bane, it ends my woe. I would not death for this that is my love, as two united in a single soul would die as one. He spoke, and crazed with love, returned to view the same face in the pool, and as he grieved, his tears disturbed the stream, and ripples on the surface, glassy clear, defaced his mirrored form. And thus the youth, when he beheld that lovely shadow go, ah, whither cost thou fly? Oh, I entreat thee, leave me not. Alas, thou cruel boy, thus to forsake thy lover. Stay with me, that I may see thy lovely form, for though I may not touch thee, I shall feed my eyes and soothe my wretched pains. And while he spoke, he rent his garment from the upper edge, and beating on his naked breast, all white as marble, every stroke produced a tint as lovely as the apple streaked with red, or as the glowing grape when purple bloom touches the ripening clusters. When his glass again the rippling waters smoothed, and when such beauty in the stream the youth observed, no more could he endure. As in the flame the yellow wax, or as the hoarfrost melts in early morning neath the genial sun, so did he pine away, by love consumed, and slowly wasted by a hidden flame. No vermeil bloom now mingled in the white of his complexion fair, no strength has he, no vigour, nor the comeliness that wrought for love so long. Alas, that handsome form by Echo fondly loved may please no more. But when she saw him in his hapless plight, though angry at his scorn, she only grieved. As often as the lovelorn boy complained, alas, alas, her echoing voice returned. And as he struck his hands against his arms, she ever answered with her echoing sounds. And as he gazed upon the mirrored pool, he said at last, ah, youth beloved in vain. In vain, the spot returned his words. And when he breathed a sad farewell, farewell, sighed Echo too. He laid his wearied head and rested on the verdant grass, and those bright eyes, which had so loved to gaze entranced on their own master's beauty, sad night closed. And now, although among the nether shades his sad sprite roams, he ever loves to gaze on his reflection in the Stygian wave. His naiad sisters mourned, and having clipped their shining tresses laid them on his corpse, and all the dryads mourned, and Echo made lament anew. And these would have upraised his funeral pyre, and waved the flaming torch, and made his bier. But as they turned their eyes where he had been, alas, he was not there. And in his body's place a sweet flower grew, golden and white, the white among the gold. Narcissus' fate, when known throughout the land and cities of Achaia, added fame deserved to blind Tiresias, mighty seer. Yet Pentheus, bold despiser of the gods, son of Echion, scoffed at all his praise, and, soul of man deriding the great seer, upbraided him his hapless loss of sight. And shaking his white temples, hoard age, Tiresias of Pentheus prophesied, O glad the day to thee, if, light denied, thine eyes, most fortunate, should not behold the Bacchanalian rites. The day will come, and soon the light will dawn, when Bacchus, born of Semele, shall make his advent known. All hail the new god Bacchus. Either thou must build a temple to this deity, or shall be torn asunder. Thy remains, throughout the forest scattered, will pollute the wood with sanguinary streams, and thy lifeblood bespatter with corrupting blood thy frenzied mother and her sisters twain. And all shall come to pass as I have told, because thou wilt not honour the new god. And thou shalt wail and marvel at the sight of blind Tiresias, though veiled in night. And as he spoke, lo, Pentheus drove the seer, but all his words, prophetic, were fulfilled, and confirmation followed in his steps. Bacchus at once appears, and all the fields resound with shouts of everybody there, men, brides, and matrons, and the howling rout, nobles and commons, and the most refined, a motley multitude, resistless born to join those rites of Bacchus, there begun. Then Pentheus cries, what madness, O ye brave descendants of the dragon, sons of Mars, what frenzy has confounded you? Can sounds of clanging brass prevail, and pipes and horns and magical delusions, drunkenness and yelling women, and obscene displays and hollow drums overcome you, whom the sword, nor troops of war, nor trumpet could affright? How shall I wonder at these ancient men, who, crossing boundless seas from distant Tyre, hither transferred their exiled household gods, and founded a new Tyre, but now are shorn, and even as captives would be led away without appeal to Mars? And, O young men of active prime, whose figure equals mine, cast down your ivy scepters, take up arms, put on your helmets, strip your brows of leaves, be mindful of the mighty stock you are, and let your souls be animated with the spirit of that dauntless dragon which, unaided, slew so many, and at last died to defend his fountain and his lake, so ye may conquer in the hope of fame. He gave the brave to death, but with your arms ye shall expel the worthless and enhance the glory of your land. If fate decree the fall of Thebes, oh, let the engines of war and men pull down its walls, and let the clash of steel and roaring flames resound. Thus, blameless in great misery, our woes would be the theme of lamentations, known to story, and our tears would shame us not. But now an unarmed boy will conquer Thebes, a lad whom neither weapons, wars, nor steeds delight, whose ringlets reek with myrrh, adorned with chaplets, purple and embroidered robes of interwoven gold. Make way for me, and I will soon compel him to confess his father is assumed, and all his rights are frauds. If in days gone, the Chryseis so helped this vain god in deserved contempt, and shut the Argive gates against his face, why, therefore, should not Pentheus close the gates of Thebes with equal courage? Hence, away, fetch the vile leader of these rioters in chains, let not my mandate be delayed. Him to restrain his grandsire, Cadmus, strove, and Athamas and many of his trusted friends united in vain efforts to rebuke his reckless rage. But greater violence was gained from every admonition. His rage increased the more it was restrained, and injury resulted from his friends. So have I seen a stream in open course run gently on its way with pleasant noise, but whensoever logs and rocks attained, it foamed with violence increased against obstruction. Presently returning came a servant stained with blood, to whom he said, "What have you done with Bacchus?" And to him they made reply, "Not Bacchus have we seen, but we have taken his attendant lad, the chosen servant of his sacred rites." And they delivered to the noble king a youth whose hands were lashed behind his back. Then Pentheus, terrible in anger, turned his awful gaze upon the lad, and though he scarce deferred his doom, addressed him thus, "Doomed to destruction, thou art soon to give example to my people by thy death. Tell me thy name, what are thy parents called, where is thy land, and wherefore art thou found attended on these bacchanalian rites?" "But fearless," he replied, "they call my name Acoetes, and Maeonia is the land from whence I came. My parents were so poor, my father left me neither fruitful fields, tilled by the lusty ox, nor fleecy sheep, nor lowing kine. For he himself was poor, and with his hook and line was wont to catch the leaping fishes, landed by his rod. His skill was all his wealth, and when to me he gave his trade, he said, 'You are the heir of my employment, therefore unto you all that is mine I give.' And at his death he left me nothing but the running waves, they are the sum of my inheritance. And, after a while, that I might not be bound forever to my father's rocky shores, I learned to steer the keel with dexterous hand, and marked with watchful gaze the guiding stars, the watery constellation of the goat, Olenian, and the bear, the Hyades, the Pleiades, the houses of the winds, and every harbour suitable for ships. So chanced it, as I made for Delos, first I veered close to the shores of Chios, where I steered by plying on the starboard oar, and nimbly leaping gained the sea-wet strand. Now, when the night was past and lovely dawn appeared, I rose from slumber, and I bade my men to fetch fresh water, and I showed the pathway to the stream. Then did I climb a promontory's height, to learn from there the promise of the winds, which having done, I called the men and sought once more my ship. Opheltes, first of my companions, cried, 'Behold, we come!' And, thinking he had caught a worthy prize in that unfruitful land, he led a boy, of virgin beauty formed, across the shore. Heavy with wine and sleep, the lad appeared to stagger on his way, with difficulty moving. When I saw the manner of his dress, his countenance and grace, I knew it was not mortal man, and being well assured, I said to them, 'What deity abideth in that form, I cannot say, but 'tis a god in truth. So, whosoever thou art, vouchsafe to us propitious waters, ease our toils, and grant to these thy grace.' At this, the one of all my mariners, who was the quickest hand, whoever was the nimblest on the yards, and first to slip the ropes, Dictys, exclaimed, 'Pray not for us,' and all approved his words. The golden head, the guardian of the prow, Melanthus, Libis, and Alcimedon approved it, and Epopius, who should urge the flagging spirits, and with rhythmic chants gave time and measure to the beating oars, and all the others praised their leader's words, so blind is greed of gain. Then I rejoined, 'Mine is the greatest share in this good ship, which I will not permit to be destroyed nor injured by this sacred fright.' And I opposed them as they came. Then Lycabas, the most audacious of that impious crew, began to rage. He was a criminal who, for a dreadful murder, had been sent in exile from a Tuscan city's gates. Whilst I opposed, he gripped me by the throat and shook me as would cast me in the deep, had I not firmly held the rope, half stunned. And all that wicked crew proved a deed. than Bacchus, be assured it was the god, as though the noise disturbed his lethargy from wine, and reason had regained its power, at last bespake the men. What deeds are these? What noise assails my ears? What means decoyed my wandering footsteps? Whither do ye lead? Fear not, the steersman said, but tell us fair the haven of your hope, and you shall land whereso your heart desires. To Naxos steer, quoth Bacchus, for it is indeed my home, and there the mariner finds welcome cheer. Him to deceive, they pledged themselves, and swore by gods of seas and skies to do his will, and they commanded me to steer that way. The isle of Naxos was upon our right, and when they saw the sails beset that way, they all began to shout at once, What ho, thou madman, what insanity is this, Echoetes, make our passage to the left. And all the while they made their meaning known by artful signs or whispers in my ears. I was amazed and answered, Take the helm, and I refused to execute their will, atrocious, and at once resigned command. They all began to murmur, and the crew reviled me. Up Bithalion jumped and said, As if our only safety is in you. With this he swaggered up and took command, and leaving Naxos steered for other shores. Then Bacchus, mocking them, as if but then he had discovered their deceitful ways, looked on the ocean from the rounded stern, and seemed to sob as he addressed the men. Ah, mariners, what alien shores are these? Tis not the land you promised, nor the port my heart desires. For what have I deserved this cruel wrong? What honour can a crew of strong men mock a boy, a lonely youth if many should deceive? And as he spoke, I also wept to see their wickedness. The impious gang made merry at our tears, and lashed the billows with their quickening oars. By Bacchus do I swear to you, and naught celestial is more potent. All the things I tell you are as true as they surpass the limit of belief. The ship stood still, as if a dry dock held it in the sea. The wandering sailors laboured at the oars, and they unfurled the sails and hopes to gain some headway with redoubled energies. The twisting ivy tangled in the oars, and interlacing held them by its weight. And Bacchus, in the midst of all, stood crowned with chaplets of grape leaves, and took a lance covered with twisted fronds of leafy vines. Around him crouched the visionary forms of tigers, lynxes, and the mottled shapes of panthers. Then the mariners leaped out, possessed by fear or madness. Medon first began to turn a swarthy hue, and fins grew outward from his flattened trunk, and with a curving spine his body bent. Then Lycabas to him, What prodigy is this that I behold? Even as he spoke, his jaws were broadened and his nose was bent. His hardened skin was covered with bright scales, and Lybus, as he tried to pull the oars, could see his own hand shrivel into fins. Another of the crew began to grasp the twisted ropes, but even as he strove to lift his arms, they fastened to his sides. With bending body and a crooked back, he plunged into the waves, and as he swam, displayed a tail, as crescent as the moon. Now here, now there, they flounce about the ship, they spray her decks with brine, they rise and sink, they rise again, and dive beneath the waves. They seem in sportive dance upon the main, out from their nostrils they spout sprays of brine, they toss their supple sides. And I alone, of 20 mariners that manned that ship, remained. A cold chill seized my limbs, I was so frightened, but the gracious god now spake me fair. Fear not, and steer for Naxos. And when we landed there, I ministered on smoking altars bacchanalian rites. But Pentheus answered him, A parlous tale, and we have listened to the dreary end, hoping our anger might consume its rage. Away with him. Hence drag him, hurl him out, with dreadful torture, into Stygian night. Quickly they seized and dragged Echoetes forth, and cast him in a dungeon triple strong. And while they fixed the instruments of death, kindled the fires, and roared the cruel irons, the legend says, though no one aided him, the chains were loosened and slipped off his arms, the doors flew open of their own accord. But Pentheus, long persisting in his rage, not caring to command his men to go, himself went forth to Mount Kithairon, where resound with singing and with trilly note the votaries of Bacchus at their rites. As when with sounding brass the trumpeter alarms of war, the mettled charger nighs and sends the battle, so the clamoured skies resounding with the dreadful outcries fret the wrath of Pentheus in his rage and flame. About the middle of the mount, with groves around its margin, was a treeless plain, where nothing might conceal. Here as he stood to view the sacred rites with impious eyes, his mother saw him first. She was so wrought with frenzy that she failed to know her son, and cast her thyrsus that it wounded him, and shouted, Hi, come hither, ho, come hither, my two sisters, a great boar hath strayed into our fields, come, see me strike and wound him. As he fled from them in fright, the raging multitude rushed after him, and as they gathered round, in cowardice he cried for mercy and condemned himself, confessing he had sinned against the gods. And as they wounded him, he called his aunt, "Otonoe, have mercy! Let the shade of sad Octaon move thee to relent." No pity moved her when she heard that name. In a wild frenzy she forgot her son. While Pentheus was imploring her, she tore his right arm out. His sister, Ino, wrenched the other from his trunk. He could not stretch his arms out to his mother, but he cried, "Behold me, mother." When Agave saw his bleeding limbs, torn, scattered on the ground, she howled and tossed her head and shook her hair that streamed upon the breeze. And when his head was wrenched out from his mangled corpse, she clutched it with her blood-smeared fingers, while she shouted, "Ho, companions, victory! The victory is ours!" So when the wind strips from a lofty tree its leaves, which touched by autumn's cold are loosely held, they fall not quicker than the wretches' bleeding limbs were torn asunder by their cursed hands. Now, frightened by this terrible event, the women of Ismenus celebrate the new Bacchantian rites, and they revere the sacred altars, heaped with frankincense